I then ask. Do you know of any bigots in your admissions office who are trying to keep blacks and Hispanics out? Not once has my question led to the identification of any bigots. Where, then, is the racism? At this point, my interlocutor typically makes the Jesse Jackson maneuver. Having failed to locate overt racism, he insists upon the pervasiveness of covert racism. The absence of individual racism inspires the allegation of institutional racism. And in this case, the culprit is the admission standard used by the selective college to decide who gets in. In particular, the villain of the story turns out to be the Scholastic Assessment Test, SAT. This test, we hear, is racially and culturally biased. I took the SAT myself in the late 1970s, and it didn't seem to me that it had been prepared by the Ku Klux Klan. The SAT seeks to measure verbal ability, reading comprehension, mathematical skill, and logical and reasoning aptitude, all of which seem quite relevant to performing well in college. It is conceivable that some questions on the verbal section of the test are biased, in that they refer to material outside the normal experience of inner-city blacks. But let us focus for a moment on the math section. The typical question goes like this. If an automobile can go at a speed of 75 miles per hour, how far can it go in 40 minutes? No one can maintain with a straight face that simple equations are racially biased or that algebra is rigged against Hispanics. Yet the performance gaps between blacks and whites are greater on the math section than on the verbal section. What this suggests is that the test is accurately measuring not innate capacity, but differences of academic performance. And on those measures of merit that selective colleges typically use, not all racial groups do equally well. So far, I have focused on a single test. So let me expand my argument by asking you to envision any test that measures intellectual achievement or economic performance. It may be a reading test given to 6-year-olds, or a math test given to 14-year-olds, or the law school admissions test, or the graduate record exam, or the business school test, or the firefighter's test, or the police sergeant test, or the civil service exam. It doesn't matter. You name the test. Now, if your chosen test is today administered to 100 randomly selected members from each of 4 groups, white, black, Hispanic, and Asian American, I will tell you in advance the result. Whites and Asians will do the best, Hispanics will fall in the middle, and African Americans, alas, will do the least well. For the past several years, I have challenged leading African American scholars to give me a single example of a test that violates the pattern of results that I have identified here. None of them have been able to do so. This is a serious problem for those who blame racial bias for the comparatively poor test results of African Americans. It is conceivable that this test or that test is flawed or biased, but to maintain that every test, in every subject, in every part of the country, is conspiratorially biased in the same way, this is absurd. The simple truth is that merit, not racism, is responsible for performance differences on the test. Merit, not racism, is the primary obstacle to enrolling larger numbers of blacks and Hispanics in selective universities. This realization has come as a surprise to many leaders of the civil rights movement. In the 1950s and 60s, Martin Luther King championed the cause of merit against that of nepotism and racial favoritism. All we are asking, King said, is that we be judged on our merits as individuals, based on the content of our character and not the color of our skins. Eventually, the leaders of the United States agreed to this. There were strong pockets of resistance, especially in the South, but the heroic persistence of King and his supporters was vindicated. There was a series of landmark rulings and laws, Brown v. Board of Education, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act, the Fair Housing Bill, which established equality of rights under the law for all citizens. Merit became the operating standard, just as King demanded. King fully expected that merit would produce diversity, and that equality of rights for individuals would lead to equality of results for groups. It has been a generation since King's death, and we now see that King's premise was false. Equality of rights for individuals has not led to equality of results for groups. Merit, like racism, produces inequality. And inequalities produced by merit are far more justifiable than inequalities produced by favoritism or racism. Consider the example of the National Basketball Association. African Americans are 12% of the population, but more than 75% of NBA players. Why then do we not hear demands for more Jews and more Asians to be represented on the courts? Presumably because it is merit that is producing this racially disproportionate result. If the coaches are picking the best dribblers and passers and shooters, then who cares if one group has more players and another group has less? If this seems like a sensible approach, it should also be applied to universities and corporations and government jobs. But here the civil rights leaders face a nightmare scenario. They know that merit standards, applied in a neutral or colorblind way, are likely to result in a kind of racial hierarchy with blacks at the bottom. The prospect of this upsets many blacks and embarrasses many whites. Racial preferences are a way to appease black discontent and reduce white embarrassment. They have nothing to do with fighting racism. Not a single one of the black or Hispanic students preferentially admitted to colleges over the years has shown that he or she has been victimized by racism. Nor have any of the white or Asian students who have been turned away despite better grades, test scores, and extracurricular talents been shown to have discriminated against anyone. A just social policy seeks to benefit those who have been harmed and impose the cost on those who have done the harming. This is not what racial preference policies do. They seek to camouflage the performance differences between racial groups and to benefit less qualified members of some groups at the expense of more qualified members of other groups. By applying two different standards, a higher one to Asians and whites, and a lower one to blacks and Hispanics, admissions officers and corporate recruiters can show a diverse outcome and pretend that all groups are performing equally well. The racial caste society is averted, but at the expense of undermining two bedrock American principles, the principle of merit and the principle of equal rights under the law. Preferences create the illusion that blacks are competitive with whites. But wouldn't it be better for blacks, in fact, to be competitive with whites? To see how this could be possible, we must candidly discuss the reasons for the merit gap. Why is it the case that on virtually every measure of academic ability and economic performance, African Americans do poorly in comparison with other groups? In this debate, there are three positions. The first position can be identified with the bell curve, the controversial book by Richard Herrnstein and Charles Murray. In it, the authors contend that there may be natural, biological differences between the races that account for their unequal levels of performance. The bell curve was written as an argument against racial preferences, although to my mind, it offers the strongest possible argument in support of such preferences. After all, if group differences are large, innate, and ineradicable, then the only alternative to the racial caste society is to set up multiple measures of performance, a kind of special Olympics, so that all groups can enjoy a measure of reward and recognition. Let us call the argument advanced by Herrnstein and Murray the genetic position. The genetic position has been challenged for the better part of a century by what may be termed the liberal position. The liberal position, argued by scholars such as Andrew Hacker, Christopher Jenks, and William Julius Wilson, says that the reason for group differences in academic achievement and economic performance is that society artificially creates such differences. In this view, societal oppression, and specifically racism, causes group inequality that otherwise would not exist. The genetic view and the liberal view have been at odds for decades, and they operate like a seesaw. When one is up, the other is down.